Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, August 7, 2020. President Salva Kiir's spokesperson reacts to Peter Beard's allegations.
Peter was associated with late Calvino Wall ago, who declared a rebellion against the government in June 2020. He probably fears the state authorities would monitor or investigate him.
And mothers in South Sudan are told to breastfeed their babies.
You can see the 96%.
We can see the 96% are not getting adequate food. This is why we can see the rate of malnutrition increase in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. President Kiir's spokesman denies that the president sent a death squad to kill Peter Beer in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Atenywe Katenya accuses Beer of allegedly leaking sensitive South Sudanese military information. The presidential spokesman told reporters in Juba today that Peter Beer created a situation in order to get his way back to the United States. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
South Sudanese activist Peter Beer Ajak fled to the United States on July 23rd with the help of the U.S. government, which issued emergency visas to him and his family. Speaking to reporters after arriving in the U.S. 2 weeks ago, Beer said President Kiir and South Sudan National Security Service Chief General Akol Kul Kuch sent a death squad to the Kenyan capital Nairobi to abduct or kill him. Presidential spokesman Atenywe Katen says that is not true.
This allegation does not stand intelligence tradition. No government with this kind of intention would be this bold and daring to pursue a dissident in a foreign country using means that best implicates it.
Aten accused Beer of signing a contract with unidentified service in Berlin, Germany in 2018 to spy for a foreign country and leak South Sudan military information.
And in July 2018, a warrant was issued for his immediate arrest. The authorities confiscated Peter electronics devices for forensic analysis, material extracted from his computer and corroborated using online data confirmed the suspicion that Peter was indeed engaged in intelligence gathering, spying on military intelligence agencies and active government officials, as well as colluding with the violent opposition.
Ateng says Beer was also involved with radicalizing South Sudanese youth against the Kiir administration and claims he advised humanitarian agencies and Western countries to stop funding South Sudan, which he says the reason Beer was arrested and detained. He was later pardoned by President Kiir. After arriving in the U.S. with the help of the U.S. State Department, Beer said the National Security Service carried out widespread extrajudicial killings, torture, and sexual abuse of prisoners in its detention facility known as the Blue House. Attenywe says Beer seemed to have other reasons for coming to the U.S., but would neither confirm or deny Beer's accusations.
Peter was associated with late Calvino Wall ago, who declared a rebellion against the government in June 2020. He probably fears the state authorities would monitor or investigate him for a potential involvement in the just-foiled insurgency. Secondly, Peter lost his residency status following a long absence from the United States. And for him to secure a return, he has to make up his stories to gain re-entry.
On his Twitter handle, Beer challenged President Kiir to, quote, prove in a U.S. federal court you did not send a death squad to abduct or murder me. If you win, I will apologize to you publicly. But if you lose, then you must resign, end quote. Attan says the government will not challenge Biar in court of law, but says Biar should not tarnish the name of his home country.
We are just telling the world that Biar did not say any truth. He has a right as a human being to seek refuge anywhere if he thinks he cannot live in his country, and any country that hosts him, okay, will host him, provided South Sudan is not a devil in this case.
Attan says Biar can still return to South Sudan should he decide to do in the future and will not be harmed. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A civil society organization is criticizing the government's approach to disarming civilians across South Sudan. A non-profit group calling itself South Sudan Action Network on Small Arms says the government lacks a proper strategy for removing arms from civilians. The group says previous multiple disarmament exercises have not removed arms from communities in various parts of South Sudan. The spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces says the current disarmament exercise in Lake State and Tonch are on voluntary basis. For VOA News, Manyang David Maya reports from Juba.
South Sudan Action Network on Small Arms Head Geoffrey Law Duke says although the government has carried out multiple disarmament exercises in the past beginning in 2006, civilians continued rearming themselves and engaging in intercommunal violence. Law says to ensure this latest round of disarmament succeeds, the government should engage community leaders in the campaign. Otherwise, he says, the government will simply repeat the mistakes of the past.
So, we believe that the communities, being the people who suffer from the violence, and also the hosts of the criminals who are causing the violence that they see, including with their neighbors, and the people who also own these firearms, and the people who are who know who has gone to raid in the neighboring communities, who has abducted children, and the people who know who are the notorious criminal in the community can suggest the security measures that needs to be taken in the planning of civilian disarmament.
Law says the government should put in place a concrete strategy that clearly outlines how the security of disarmed communities will be guaranteed and explain how the government will dispose of the recovered weapons to ensure they don't make their way back into communities.
It also includes clear measures needed to build confidence between and among communities, especially those with recent history of violent interactions. The strategy should also include a mechanism to monitor, document, report, and bring to justice members of the disarmament forces that may abuse civilians during the process of civilian disarmament.
Law worries disarmament exercises, which will be carried out by the military, will only create more havoc in communities where intercommunal violence is rampant. Army spokesman Major General Lu Rai Kong says government forces were invited by the communities where disarmament exercises are occurring in Tonch and Lagos states.
What we are using in Tonch now, where disaster is ongoing, is that we are divided into two phases. Phase one is voluntary disarmament, and we gave the traditional leaders the lead in carrying out registration of all the youth they know that are carrying guns.
Kong says if the voluntary pace fails, the military will be left with no other option but to force civilians to give up their weapons. Once the campaign is completed, he says soldiers will provide security to communities.
Most of these communities that have been fighting among themselves never look at the guns they are having as a source of protection. They have been using it to kill themselves. And therefore, once they have removed, we remove the guns, we have secure force that are going to be deployed so that they are protected.
Kong says after disarming communities in Tony and Lakes State, government forces will move on to other regions of the country affected by intercommunal violence. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
This week marks an end to global breastfeeding campaign aimed at encouraging mothers to feed their babies with breast milk. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 92% of mothers in South Sudan breastfeed their babies. The week-long advocacy is to encourage mothers to breastfeed their babies until the age of 6 months. The campaign also encourages families to give space between children so that the mother can devote herself to one baby at a time. For VOA News, Viola Elias reports from Juba.
South Sudanese Helen James, a mother of a 6-month-old baby boy, says she has been breastfeeding her baby exclusively despite the many challenges she faces, including not having enough food to eat. James says most times her breast milk wasn't enough for the baby. She says breastfeeding mothers need to eat nutritious food to produce high quantities of milk, but for her and many other South Sudanese moms, that is not possible due to economic hardship.
Things are even hard in the market, things are high prices. So even like in a day you can eat only one meal. So that and even is not going to be enough. So at least if like you can eat 3 times in a day, that's whereby you have enough milk for the baby. My message to the government, if like every day women are giving birth in the hospital, so if like they can do give some support like food items.
Rebecca Ladu, another breastfeeding mother, says economic challenges brought caused by coronavirus pandemic have made it difficult for her to breastfeed her 2-month-old baby exclusively. Speaking in Arabic, Ladu says she wakes up early each morning to search for food for her 5 children.
We women in Juba used to breastfeed our babies for the period of 6 months, but now, with the COVID-19 situation in the country, our business has declined. We are running up and down and there is no money because most time we come back late at home, so it becomes difficult to always breastfeed babies at a late hours.
Priscilla Bayo, a nutrition specialist at UNICEF, says the good news is South Sudan has seen an increase in the rate of breastfeeding. Bayo says South Sudan has more than 40 nutrition partners in different counties of the country. Noting the challenges many women face, she urges the government should increase the length of maternity leaves so women can exclusively breastfeed their babies for at least 6 months.
We have a lot of mothers working in the field, maybe farming, doing agriculture work, or some are working in the markets selling vegetables, and we have mothers working with the government or NGO. And the government of South Sudan now give only 2 months maternity leave.
Bayo says UNICEF and its partner organizations are working hard to advocate for breastfeeding the first 6 months of a baby's life. She says only 4% of children in the country receive proper complementary food after 6 months.
We can see the 96% are not getting adequate food. This is why we can see the rate of malnutrition increase in South Sudan.
Bayo says providing children with complementary food after 6 months is very important for children growing up healthy. The 7-day World Breastfeeding Week advocacy encourages mom to breastfeed their babies for 6 months and encourages families to give enough space between children so the mother can devote herself to one baby at a time. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, what is happening in Uganda's preparations for elections? That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
If you could relive an age, what age would you like to be?
I would like to go back to my secondary school days because there are other things that I see that I did not do well. I was very childish.
I would say that the age between 20 and 22nd. By that time, I think I was very more handsome than today and I was energetic than today.
That's 18, because it's the time I enjoyed most. I got to know more about life, what the world is all about.
I would like to be at the age of 17, because at that time, we go out for hunting, playing football, or a lot of entertaining activities.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A new opinion poll indicates that none of Uganda's main presidential candidates meet the constitutional threshold to win next year's presidential election. The poll was conducted in March before the coronavirus pandemic. It shows incumbent President Yoweri Museveni at 47% popularity, while lawmaker and musician Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, polled at 22%. Long-term opposition leader Kizza Besigye got 17%. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke to Patrick Wakida, CEO of World Research International, which conducted the poll.
The finding of this survey shows that had the election been conducted in March, precisely from the period of 5th and 18th, probably Mr. Museveni would have gotten 47% of the total rating. Bobi Wine would have gotten 22%, and Dr. Kizza Besigye would have gotten 17%. That is the finding that we have.
If I may ask you, how scientific is this polling? Because I understand some opposition groups, supporters of Bobi Wine and supporters of Kizza Besigye, are kicking against this finding, saying their presidential candidate or aspiring presidential candidate appears to be more popular than President Museveni.
It is okay for somebody to have his personal opinion, but sometimes your opinion or your perception of things could be different from others. And that is, I think, the irony that this country has, or everybody has.
Now, Dr. Wakida, I'm sure you are aware that often the opposition say that the institutions of government are able to steal the elections for President Museveni. This finding shows that that narrative might not be accurate. Is this what your findings concluded?
One very important finding in this research, which people are not talking about, is that for the first time in the polling of this country, you have Mr. Museveni scoring well below 50%, meaning that had election been conducted in March, none of the candidates would have scored 50+1. Which is a requirement of the constitution for you to become a president. So the situation we would have seen for the first time would have been that of a rerun. That's one. Two, whether the elections are rigged to keep Mr. Museveni in power, it could be true that there is rigging. But there is something you can't discount. That Mr. Museveni, ever since 2016 election, he has not allowed any opponent to go out there. Dr. Kizza Besigye has not done any rally since 2016 election. So the conditions in this country does not in any way allow for opposition to claim victory or even to go and convince people to claim victory.
Based on your findings and the figures that you just spoke about, does that mean the opposition would have a chance to significantly pose a threat to the president if they were to unite in the next year's elections?
Yes, if they did unite, it would create a momentum. Unity would have a momentum effect, and the momentum effect would probably create an opportunity and probably a possibility of overriding and overrunning the state state apparatus. But individually, it's going to be very difficult.
That was Patrick Wakida, CEO of World Research International, speaking with my colleague Peter Cloti. Last week, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta ordered county authorities to carry out a nationwide crackdown on medical clinics that give emergency contraceptives to girls. Emergency contraceptives are safe ways to prevent pregnancy after unprotected sexual intercourse. But in Kenya, it's illegal for clinics to give the medication to girls under 18 years old. Kenyatta alleges that clinics offering contraceptives to underage girls are promoting promiscuity and making it easier for sexual predators to take advantage of girls. Some medical professionals and women rights activists have criticized the president's order. Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi spoke with Audrey Wabweri, senior press officer at Human Rights Watch Kenya.
There's been many media reports about teen pregnancies in Kenya in the past few weeks. In April, Human Rights Watch reported about young girls who are being abused while they're out of school during the lockdown. But the Kenya government didn't come out to address the issue at the time. Now, more than ever, children need protection from their abusers. They need age-appropriate sex education so that they know when they're in harm's way. Of course, health facilities should work within the confines of the law, but cracking down on health facilities that have offered services to children will not necessarily solve the problem of sex among minors or predators who are preying on children. Instead, the government should now work with relevant stakeholders to think about how to take care of the pregnant girls, to prevent teen pregnancies by ensuring that children can report sexual abuse and find justice.
President Kenyatta feels that maybe when there will be no contraceptives, the girls will now be very careful and not to engage in some sexual acts. Do you think that this is going to work for the government, or they should just let it be and let the clinics continue offering the family planning services for the underage girls, at least to control the teenage pregnancies?
What has been proven to work in preventing teen pregnancies around the world in several places is age-appropriate sex education, because this education teaches children, it helps them understand how they are changing as they continue to grow. Cracking down on health institutions, pretending that these things are not happening, those strategies are not going to work, because those are the strategies that have been used for a very long time till now, and we are still seeing many teenagers getting pregnant. So now is the time to change tact, to move towards information, and also protecting children and not blaming them when these things happen. Because when children are growing, what they need is support, what they need is information, they need protection. That is what they need, and that is what will protect them.
That was Audrey Wabweri, senior press officer at Human Rights Watch Kenya, speaking to Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi. Amid the long-running dispute between Egypt and Ethiopia over the Nile Dam, African refugees in Cairo say racism and hostility against them are intensifying. VOA's Heather Modok has more from Istanbul with Hamada Al-Rassam in Cairo.
300 million people depend on the Nile River to survive, and in Egypt, 95% of the population lives along the river. Upstream from Egypt is Ethiopia. Ethiopia has built a nearly $5 billion dam project it says will provide electricity to 65 million people and help lift the country out of poverty. Egypt sees the possibility of lower water levels as a threat to its very existence. Ethiopian refugees in Egypt are caught in the middle. Taher Omar Huru is an Ethiopian refugee and a local refugee community leader in Cairo. He says there has been a rise in hate speech, harassment, and violence against Ethiopians or people perceived to be Ethiopian, raising fear among refugees. Egypt hosts more than 100,000 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa, and many of them say they are the target of open hostility on the streets because of the dispute over the dam. With increased racism, even simple things are more difficult, say refugee advocates. This is Noor Khalil, a legal consultant for refugees and migrants. He says black refugees are commonly discriminated against because locals assume they are Ethiopian and they want to block the water. Online, Egyptians and Ethiopians taunt each other. Ethiopian TikTok users suggest Egypt will be completely cut off from the Nile. Egyptian users retort with posts about Egypt's considerable military prowess. This is Michael Thabet, a Cairo resident. He says the online bickering is fueling growing tensions on the ground. Egypt's critics say the country has long used its power to bully its neighbors and control the Nile. Critics of Ethiopia say that without a legally binding agreement regulating the use of the dam, the country could devastate its downstream neighbors and violate international law. Egypt, Ethiopia, and Sudan are still in talks, trying to negotiate a deal as the reservoir is slowly being filled up. But sub-Saharan refugees in Egypt say the anger on the ground is misdirected against them. They say, if Egyptians go thirsty, we will go thirsty too. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Sweet Mother by Prince Nico. Listening to Prince Nico with the song Sweet Mother. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to do your part to fight COVID in South Sudan by washing your hands with soap, practicing social distancing, and not escaping from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.